Big Bang. And as you can see, it's very relevant, even in popular culture. The teenage crowd really cares. Should look up the episode and see what they're actually talking about, but probably I don't want to know. Okay, so can you see that? So the idea with the Big Bang is we see that everything is moving apart. If everything is moving apart and we go backwards in time, then the energy density of the universe has to be increasing. It gets hotter. You could actually even think of it as if you did an adiabatic compression of the gas. So the other way around is if you have a gas that expands and you have no heat flowing in or out, it gets cold. So you know this if you ever do a spray bottle of something that's under pressure on the spray can. And when you squirt it, your finger gets cold. Because basically, the gas is coming out, and when it expands and there's no time for heat to flow in and out of it, it basically gets, the temperature drops like a drop. So if you go backwards, it gets hot, which if you pump up a bicycle tire, as you pump it up, if you feel the nozzle, you can tell it's getting hot. So, I don't know if you can see that very well. So, as we go backwards, the universe gets very hot, and what that means is the energy of the interactions changes and gets very hot. And so as we go backwards in time, from today all the way back to about 13.7-ish billion years ago, the energy density rises dramatically. And for the vast majority of the time, because this is a log scale if you look at it, so what I'm plotting here is time after the Big Bang. This is a measure of temperature. And this is a measure of the energy of the typical reaction that takes place. So, when particles hit each other and everything. So what you might notice is that for the vast majority of the time in here, everything is sort of as we perceive it, more or less. It may get hotter as we go back in time, but the energy that you have is insufficient to really fundamentally change what it is that we have. But as you go back to about 300,000 years after the Big Bang, which would be about 13.3-ish billion years ago, it gets hot enough that the typical interaction was such that neutral atoms like this, where the electron is bound around the atom, can no longer exist. Because when there's that much energy there, the atoms hit each other, the photons that are produced have enough energy that they basically ionize the atoms. And so what that means is beyond that time, as you go backwards, we lived in a universe where you had photons, some basic particles like electrons and some protons and neutrons, and then some nuclei, light nuclei, but you had nothing like a neutral atom. And it turns out that means a lot of this are electrically charged particles. And when you have light and you try to send it through an electrically charged gas, it doesn't go very far. It gets absorbed and scattered. So what that means is that the universe, after this mark at around 380-ish thousand years after the Big Bang, is transparent to light, and before that it's opaque. So if we think of the history of the universe as it's expanding and cooling, there's a phase transition that happened at about 380,000 years after the Big Bang, where there's a bunch of energy in the universe and there is all sorts of light floating around, but that light is going through something that's basically opaque, so you can't image anything, and we really don't see the light before that time. But then, a way to think about it is at about that time, the universe basically, a switch was thrown, the temperature dropped to the point where the charged particles could combine into neutral atoms, and the universe just became transparent. So any photon that was in flight at that time, of which there was all over the place, basically could just keep going. And what that means is that the universe is filled with those photons, that light. And that's what we call the cosmic microwave background, cosmic microwave radiation. As we go further back in time, you reach a point where even the nucleons, the protons and neutrons, don't exist. And we have the quarks and the gluons and things that make up the protons and neutrons. We have a plasma of that stuff. So there was certainly another phase transition in there. So as you go back in time and learn more about different types of particles and the forces, you can sort of picture different phase transitions in here. And the density is changing. If in principle... If we had a detector that could detect really low energy neutrinos, for example, those can go straight through that plasma that we talked about that the photons can't take. So in principle, we should be able to see free streaming neutrinos from very, very early in the universe. There should be a cosmic neutrino background, but nobody's yet figured out a way to actually see those. But we can see the photons, and we'll talk a lot about that and have been, and we'll continue to. There is this period between the time that we have a phase transition at about 1 microsecond. Okay, this is 10^-5 seconds. So that's 1 microsecond after the Big Bang, where the universe made a phase transition from an energy and density that's about what we see inside a proton into something that's less energetic, less dense. And when that happens, the quarks and the gluons and stuff that were in this universe had to condense into neutrons and protons. And then the universe kept expanding, and as it expanded, those protons and neutrons, some of them would interact, and we would actually form light nuclei. So we would form. So we had mostly hydrogen, remember, it's just bare protons. The neutrons, the free neutrons, are decaying, and they'll decay with a lifetime that's something on the order of 8 minutes. Somewhere in there. It's minutes. And so those neutrons are decaying away, but some of them get glom on the protons and they form light particles like lithium and helium and such. And then the neutrons, the ones that are free, have mostly decayed away, and the universe is expanding, so you have fewer collisions. So the process of creating the light nuclei comes to a stop at about 3 minutes after the Big Bang. And the physics that happens at that density is stuff we do in the laboratories all the time. So we understand basic nuclear physics. And our model of how those a gas of protons and neutrons might combine during that time in the light nuclei is pretty reasonable. And what we find is that we can predict at the end of that 3 minutes what the matter distribution in the universe should have been in terms of how much hydrogen, how much deuterium, how much tritium, how much lithium, how much beryllium, etc. And that should have really been the starting stuff of our universe as it then continued to expand. Because what happens later on is this is just basically where the nuclei combine with electrons and form neutral atoms. So at this point we have neutral hydrogen and neutral lithium and such. And then we have the light, the cosmic microwave background, that just continues to stream through. Occasionally, a photon will hit a planet, or it'll hit a nucleus or something. But by and large, most of the light that's produced at this point in the universe just continues to go. We can predict pretty well what the distribution of these light nuclei happen to be. And we observe it when we look at intergalactic space. So this is a major, major prediction of the Big Bang. One of the other things that's a major prediction of the Big Bang is this light that comes from about 380,000 years after the Big Bang. We don't just know that there's life, and we don't just know that it has to come to us from all directions because the whole universe is filled with it. We know what the temperature of the universe was at that time, and we know how black body spectrum works. Remember, black body is the distribution and intensity of the frequencies of light that are emitted by a glowing object. And that's what the universe was at the stage. It was an object that was glowing at about 3,000 degrees. And you can take an object and put it at 3,000 degrees in the laboratory today and figure out exactly what the spectrum of the light that was around in the universe at that time should have been. And that's not what we see. If you look out in the sky, everything isn't glowing like something bright at 3,000 degrees, which would be like taking a hot poker and, you know, it'd be really, really bright, and you'd be able to see it. And the reason for that is because these photons have been flowing around in the universe where the space itself has been expanding, and that actually has changed the wavelength of the photons, effectively redshifting them to a different frequency. So it turns out that they lie in the microwave, and the distribution of the frequencies is exactly a black body spectrum. So the Big Bang model gives you a very particular prediction of the microwave background. It has to come from all over the place. It should basically be uniform. It has to have a black body curve, and we can even tell you what the peak energy or peak frequency of that thing happens to be. Right. And we see it. So these are pretty precise, pretty amazing predictions. Doesn't mean it tells us everything. Just to get a sense of how crazy some of this is, here I plot on the scale of energy that we're talking about. Remember, as we go back in time toward the Big Bang, we go up in energy. And so as we go back, we go back to about 10 to the minus 10 seconds. This is 10 to the minus 35 seconds, roughly, where I have this black line. And the energy is going up. So this is 100 GeV would be the typical interaction at this particular line. And the LHC is probing energy somewhere in here. So that's at times that are substantially shorter than 10 to the minus 10 seconds after the Big Bang. So as we project back to the density of the universe, very well understood physics gets us to this point. We're not even projecting craziness beyond that. I mean, how do I say it? Up to that point, we're not projecting craziness into the picture. It's actually well understood physical processes. We know the kinds of particles that are there. We know how the forces work. Any thoughts, questions? Okay. So you can see here, we're going to spend a lot of time talking about this area right now, because we do have to project into densities and things where you can argue maybe we don't have great knowledge as to what might have happened. But maybe we do. So let's go on. So let me recap a little bit then. Why we believe in this crazy idea that we came. We know that the galaxies are all moving away from us because we understand how far away they are from looking at different things. The main standard candle these days is the brightness of particular types of supernovas. They're amazingly bright. And by studying those, and knowing how the absolute brightness of certain types of supernovas go as a function of time, because they usually, basically the star explodes in, you know, over a period of 2 or 3 days. And during that period, for stars of a certain size, there's a light curve. The intensity of the light as a function of time is very characteristic. And we've seen those close enough that we actually understand what the absolute luminosity is based on this light curve. So we can look at those in very, very distant galaxies. And so what we know is by looking at those and comparing the spectral lines and understanding how much they're redshifted, we know that the galaxies are moving away from us, and the further away from us, the faster they're moving away from us. So it makes us say that the universe is expanding. You take that craziness and you go backwards, then you get this idea that we had to have a Big Bang. If we had a Big Bang, then it means you have certain phase transitions that you can see, one of which is the point where it goes from opaque to transparent, and the photons around the universe at that time should be free-streaming. They should come at us from all over the sky. They should basically be uniform, and they should come at a certain microwave frequency with the black body radiation, and there's a picture of it right there. It is observed. It was discovered in the 1960s. It is a perfect black body radiation coming from all directions in the sky. In addition, if we look at the fraction of the material in the universe, here's a fraction of one, that is made up of different types of matter, protons and neutrons here at about almost everything, okay? And then this is time, this is the temperature, and this is the time after the Big Bang. And basically, there's a period in here at about, you know, a microsecond to 3 minutes where we have this small nuclei being formed, and we can calculate how many of those nuclei were around as a fraction of this fraction of the mass of the universe is a log scale, so you don't have much beryllium compared to the hydrogen and helium up here. And what you see is as you go out in time, these lines are basically flat. And that's telling you your model predicted those fractions, and they stay constant after that point because they're stable nuclei, so nothing much changes. And then when we go out and we look at the light nuclei, we see that distribution. And I'm not showing you the data here, but that's what we see. This is known as Big Bang nucleosynthesis. Again, very solid prediction of the Big Bang, and that's what we see. So what are the various problems with the Big Bang? First of all, what I hope I've done is I hope you understand the case for the Big Bang is really compelling. Okay, it's not contentious among physicists. That said, if you say, okay, the Big Bang happened, what are the problems with this theory? And I mean scientific problems. Okay? You might come up with, depending on your religion, you might have lots of serious problems. I'm not saying that you might not, but scientifically, what are the problems with the Big Bang if you take it seriously? Well, one issue is that, remember, in general relativity, you describe space-time as being more or less a fabric, and energy and mass can bend that fabric. So, if you were to just take this theory and say, okay, what is the basic fundamental large-scale curvature of the space in the universe, there's no constraint that comes out of general relativity, really. And you could basically have anything. And I'm going to show you evidence in a minute that comes from our studies of the cosmic microwave background, but I'll just skip ahead to the conclusion from that. It turns out that when we look at the large-scale geometry of the universe, it appears to be extraordinarily close to being flat. And a flat plane in a theory where anything is possible, basically, is a very special case. And that's a problem. Why is that a problem?
Is it too greedy?
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. The theory can do it. But you don't want, in a scientific theory, to have something that is convenient. You want to have the processes that are involved in your theory drive you toward special numbers, if you have special numbers. So if the geometry of the universe is very close to being flat, there damn well better be a good reason for it. And the Big Bang, in and of itself, has no good reason for it. Okay? That's a real problem. Very special case. So I'll tell you how we know the geometry in a few minutes. Okay, it gets worse, actually. There is the singularity problem, which is, as you project backwards in this whole crazy Big Bang picture, the energy density and the matter density and everything goes infinite. And all of your equations break down. We have no idea what it's like back then. Okay? So physics as we know it effectively breaks down as you go all the way back to what we call the singularity. So what do you do with that? That's a problem. And that, in and of itself, doesn't kill the Big Bang theory, but it is a big and glaring hole because you can't say much about it. Then there are a couple of other problems. Okay, so the problem I just alluded to with the geometry is called the flatness problem. Here's a huge problem. We call it the horizon problem. Fundamentally, if we look at the cosmic microwave background coming from all directions of the sky today, what we see is that it's the same frequency distribution of light this way as it is that way, if you take into account the local motion of Earth through the universe. So if we're moving this way, light, if we're moving, you know, if light is coming at us from the universe, going toward this, it would look a little bit bluer and away from here, it's a little better. So if you correct for that, then the light that we see coming from this direction and the light we see coming from that direction looks exactly the same. Okay? What that means is that at the time that light was emitted, at 380,000 years after the Big Bang, the point where that light was emitted and the point where that light was emitted, they were glowing at the same time, because they have the same black body curve. Otherwise, they would look different. Okay? To 1 part in 10 to the 5th. In degrees. That's a lot, actually. That's like saying, you know, it is 69 degrees in Tampa, and it is 69.00001 in New York City, or something close to like that. So within 1 part in 10 to the 5th, the basic peak color, that is the temperature of the universe at the time the cosmic microwave background was emitted, was completely uniform. Okay, you say, so what? The so what is, in the picture of the fundamental Big Bang, remember, the light that's coming to us from over here is coming from a place that was 13.7 billion light years away from us. You have to correct a little bit for the expansion of the universe, but basically, that light is coming from a point in the universe that was way outside our observable universe at the time. The observable universe, the size of the observable universe, at the moment that the light that comes to us now in the cosmic microwave background was seen, was about 380,000 light years in size, because the universe had only been around that long. So, okay? But the light that is hitting us now is coming from a part of the universe that was way outside our observable universe at that time. The issue is that the light that's coming from over here and the light that's coming from over here at 380,000 light years after the Big Bang were not in each other's observable universe. That is, they had never been causally connected. So how in the world does this part of the universe know that it's got to have a temperature to one part of 10 to the fifth the same as that part of the universe, and they've never been in causal contact? I can take two pots of water and make them the same temperature, connecting. But if I have a pot of water way over there and a pot of water over here, and they've never had any evidence of each other's existence, to find them to have the same temperature to one part of 10 to the fifth, that's a problem. It's called the horizon problem. And it's a real big problem with the Big Bang. So much so that it gives people thinking about Big Bang a big pause. So one way of looking at it is this way. At the time that the light coming to us from the cosmic microwave background was emitted, that is 380,000 years after the Big Bang, you can imagine that our observable universe, if this is us, or what was to become us as the universe evolved, the light that we were causally connected to, the part of the universe that we had a chance to be causally connected to, is about this big. The light that is reaching us now is coming to us from a region of space that was far outside our observable universe at the time. That is about 13.7 billion light years in size. And the part of the universe, if we look to one side, that was causally connected to the region of space where we're seeing cosmic microwave background light from today was only about this big. And if we look at another part of the sky, it was only about this big. And in the Big Bang, this part of the sky, this part of the universe, and that part of the universe had never had a chance to be cosmically connected. So the fact that we see an absolutely, to one part in 10 to the fifth, uniform light coming at us from all directions in the Big Bang is a very real problem. Okay? Any questions about that? Did you have a question that I then forgot about?
What does a flat universe mean? Like, are you saying...
Just kidding, because I'm going to do more with that.
I'm just a little confused about how you could have light reaching us from a point that was at one time causally disconnected from us, because if the universe is expanding, wouldn't it just keep expanding out?
Yeah, it is, but our visible universe, that is the part of the universe that we're causally connected to, is literally growing with the radius of the speed of light.
Right.
Okay. And so what I'm really saying is early in the universe, we have a region of space that was basically the radius of which is the distance light could go times the age of the universe. And that doesn't mean there isn't space outside of that. It just means this is all we had a chance to basically see with the telescope if we were alive at that time.
Okay.
And so if you now ask, what are we seeing? We're seeing light, because the light that we see now, cosmic microwave background, has to travel to us from much farther away than that, because it hadn't reached us at the time it was emitted. It took it 13.7 billion years to get here. So it had to be emitted from someplace way far away, on that scale.
Okay.
So our observable universe is now, you know, that size, and we're seeing effectively the points in space that are 13.7 billion years from where we were at the moment. So one of the issues that we're going to face more and more as we go from here to the end of the class is sort of picturing the universe as our little observable bubble, when in fact even this tells us that there is a great reality out there that's thought to be larger than what we currently see. Which is a bit strange if you think about it, but that's sort of what you're seeing. Yeah.
They actually observed like a light source, you know, arriving that wasn't there in the sky before. How is that unfolding with the universe so big that that light, the speed of light versus expansion is like almost meaningless?
It's actually the other way around, you know. But we'll get there. The expansion of the universe is accelerating, so in fact, if you project, if you project forward, the expansion of space is going to outstrip the speed of light going out and the fraction of the reality that we will be able to see as part of our observable universe is going to shrink. So it's that wasn't the case earlier on.
All right, so the horizon problem is a very, very serious problem. Here's a different way of looking at it. I think as one of the readings that I want you to do this week is to look at a website written by, put together by a guy named Hugh White at the University of Chicago. And I stole a figure from him off his website, so that accounts for why it's very hard to read this. Didn't work so well when I just extracted the figure. So sorry about that. But let us imagine, first I want you to forget this piece for the moment. Let's not worry about it. But let's basically say whatever happens, happens. The universe is expanding. This you can think of as distance, this dimension. Okay? So if the universe is very small, hasn't been around very long, you can imagine that as in this direction is time. As a function of time, the region of the universe that is equal to the age of the universe times the speed of light, that is the region of the universe, the size of the region of the universe that we are causally connected to is in here, between these two purple lines. So as time goes, that region of the universe gets much bigger. So in the present day, this corresponds to about 13.7 billion years, light years in size. In the earlier days, it was much smaller. Okay, so we are causally connected to this region of space. If we were to, if we look at light that's coming to us now, cosmic microwave background, the light that reaches us today was emitted at a time when the light from the cosmic microwave background was released. At the time it was emitted, it had to be emitted from a region of space that was far outside our observable region. And that light then travels and travels and travels and eventually comes and hits us, 13.7 billion. So, a couple of different ways to try to picture this. Yeah?
Doesn't that mean that that light has to come from another universe? Because
no.
There's not enough space.
Depends on, I mean, we have to be a little careful how we define the universe. Okay? That light comes from a region of space that was outside the piece of the universe that we could observe at that time. And we are now observing because time has passed and that part of the universe's light is now reaching us.
So that the space existed before the universe expanded within it?
No, I would think more of it as the space exists and it's all expanding. The piece we're sensitive to is growing at the speed of light here. And the light that reaches us 13.7 billion years was emitted from out here relative to how big we were 14,000 years.
Okay.
Did that reach?
It's really confusing to me.
Well, don't think of it as a balloon. Think of it as there is a reality that's much. I mean, remember, whatever happened at the very start, if you could imagine that you were alive and able to make an observation there, at 10 microseconds after the Big Bang, your observable universe is only 10 microseconds times the speed of light in size. So if whatever has turned into our universe was bigger than that, then you're only sensitive to the small region of it.
Okay?
So then you might say, If that's true, all I have to do is wait an infinite amount of time, and I will be sensitive to an infinite amount of space, and therefore I will eventually be causally connected to any part of reality that has ever been. Okay? Which makes complete sense, except the universe is expanding. So the further out you go, the faster the space is receding from you. Which basically means if you look at the fraction of the great reality which will eventually be encompassed by our observable universe, that is, the fraction of the space where there's been enough time for light to eventually reach us, and you look at the space and you realize it's expanding, as you go further out, it's actually expanding away from you far faster than the light travels, so that even if you waited an infinite amount of time, the region of the observable universe that you'll ever be connected to is finite. So if you can argue that the great reality out there is bigger than that, then you get a type 1 multiverse, according to Tegmark's definition, or what I call beyond the horizon multiverse. It's quite simply that you have a universe, a reality, that is vastly larger than a region through which, even if you wait forever, you will ever be connected to. Okay? And so then, you know, is that big? Is it little? So we're going to talk a lot about that. Actually, we believe it's extremely big. And that's a form of the multiple universe.
For completeness, I forgot to add in one of the reasons we believe. Sorry, I do have it in here. Okay, so we've talked about the singularity problem, the horizon problem, the flatness problem. There's a different problem, which is called the monopole problem. I don't know to what extent this stuck in your mind, but at some point I flashed Maxwell's equations up for you. And they are not completely symmetric in E and D, that is, with the electric field and magnetic field. And the reason is, if you think of an electric charge and you think of the field, you can think of electric charge as being point sources of electric field. You draw the field lines coming directly out from it. For the magnetism, it turns out you don't have such a thing. What you have are things like bar magnets, where the magnetic field lines sort of curl around. So you've done a recitation where you did that. There is no object where the magnetic field lines just sort of seem to emerge or vanish. The thing is, theoretically, people believe such a thing should exist, because if it did exist, it in fact would make symmetry in Maxwell's equations, and there are deep theoretical reasons to sort of believe it should exist. If it did exist, these things would be known as magnetic monopoles. And my understanding is, when you calculate these energy densities at the early stage of the universe, that you think many magnetic monopoles should have been formed. And if you do very sensitive experiments and you look for these magnetic monopoles, basically building devices that if a magnetic monopole goes near it, it'll give you a signal, they've never been seen. So the fact that we don't see magnetic monopoles, which should have been formed at the very start of the universe with a reasonable density, is a very weird problem, which I think is, to the extent these are intuitive, is even less intuitive than these, but nevertheless, scientifically, it's a big puzzle. Okay. And then lastly, if we want to talk about problems with the Big Bang, you can argue that we have the large-scale structure problem.
Why, if you have some infinitely dense something that just decides to start expanding? Why is the matter, why is the energy not distributed evenly? And if it's distributed evenly, then how did we get planets and dogs and galaxies and galactic clusters? Because the way in which you get all that structure is you have to have non-uniformities in the early universe, which should correspond to non-uniformities in the cosmic microwave background, which in fact we do see at one part to the fifth. So it's a big deal, and you'll hear more about it this afternoon. It's a very big deal when that was discovered. But then the issue is with the Big Bang, how did these small non-uniformities in the cosmic microwave background come from? What I mean by that is, if I look at the temperature of the cosmic microwave background right there and somewhere over here, they actually aren't identical. They do differ by one part to the fifth. Why do I care? Because if this part was a little hotter, then it means that 380,000 years after the Big Bang, that little part of the universe was a little hotter, which means it had a little more energy, which basically turned into matter, and that's where gravity would collect. You have a higher density, and that's where you would begin to form galactic clusters. Okay? If it was completely smooth, you'd never have anything that could give you any structure. So within the basic Big Bang theory itself, there is nothing that tells you why you have the structure that we see in the universe. And you can even map it out, right? You can take deep pictures like this. This is a Hubble deep field picture, where you can basically try to map out the size of the different types of structures that we see in our universe. And you know, people have done this. It's one of the things astronomers do. So where does that come from in a Big Bang theory where you basically should end up with a perfectly homogeneous universe? Okay? The Big Bang is compelling. Compelling evidence. Thou should believe. The Big Bang can't possibly be right. Okay? But it's just not going to pop. So, welcome to the world, circa 1980. How do you fix that? And I think it takes such an absurd situation like this to make what I'm about to tell you make any sense, or to be even slightly palatable. Because when I first heard about it, I think I just started laughing. I thought, no way. So there is a way to fix this. And it's known as cosmic inflation. It was a crazy idea that I think was put forth by some Russians some time ago, but they published in something obscure during the Soviet Union days. Nobody paid much attention. And a guy named Alan Guth at MIT, he's alive, still there, sort of got the idea independently and started pushing it along with a few others, okay? And basically they came up with a really wacky idea which fixes all the problems with the Big Bang. But it comes at a price, conceptually, but it also has huge implications. So here's their idea. We take this picture that we looked at earlier. And let's look back at early times. What they say is the following. They say that the universe, what became our universe, started very small. You actually can even make it come from nothing. Right? It's a very strange concept because there was no space. Right? But let us, for a moment, just say, I don't know what's there. So let's just say for a moment, I mean, actually, we can There are different concepts. But let us suppose for a moment that we basically just have a quantum fluctuation in energy. Okay? How this can happen, we'll talk a lot about, but just humor me for a moment. Let us suppose that you have a very tiny universe. Basically, you have a little tiny quantum fluctuation that happens. When that happens, you have this uncertainty in energy. And let us say that the space that appears and is part of this quantum fluctuation has a strange characteristic. And that characteristic is such that the space will expand superluminally, vastly faster than the speed of light. Now, we'll talk a bit about how, when you first hear that, you think, now you're smoking something that can't possibly be true. It is crazy, but you can actually take Einstein's field equations, and if you imbue the vacuum with a potential energy that is large enough, you can have the equations basically give you space that expands this crazy way. It's called inflation. So how do you imbue the vacuum and think of it as having potential energy? We'll talk about a couple of different ways of doing this. But what I want you to just swallow for the moment is that serious, real physicists can dream up reasonable ways that are consistent with what we know about the universe that will give empty space this kind of potential energy. And so it's not quite as crazy as it sounds, but let us suppose for a moment that we have something that causes a tiny quantum region of space to have this characteristic. If that space is created, then this space will expand superluminally. Okay? And you might say, wait a minute, that has not been their conservation of energy. Alright, humor me for a moment, we'll come back to that. Okay? Let us just imagine that this happened for a moment. And look at what happens to all the problems of the Big Bang if you were to believe that this could possibly happen. So the idea is you start really small, whatever it is, and then you get vastly larger, effectively instantaneously. This is time, remember? This is at about 10 to the minus 37 seconds after the Big Bang, and this is about 10 to the minus 35-ish seconds after the Big Bang. So we're talking about a time that is infinitesimally short, and during that time, space becomes very, very large. If we use the other picture, I don't remember where I put it. No, not there. If we use this picture, what we're saying is that over almost an instant, the universe goes from something we're causally connected to, very, very small, to something that's vastly larger than what we see as part of our observable universe. Okay, this is known as inflation, this crazy idea. So it does sound completely absurd, at least I thought so. But let us look at the implications of it if it were true before we swallow it. So let me look at a couple of numbers, though. So these tiny fluctuations could be very small. So quantum fluctuations are really tiny. So you might start out really small. Let me not worry about going through words here. Let's talk for a moment about energy conservation before we talk about how this fits with all the problems that we've been. What I've done is I take a piece of the universe and I make it very, very big. Okay? You think, well, that's got to take a lot of energy to do that. And it does. So you would think by doing that, you have to violate energy conservation. There's a very odd thing, though. if we look at the total energy that's there, as this thing is expanding, the space and the matter, you know, the energy, basically we think of it as having kinetic energy in an expansion. But as it's doing that, you actually can also think of, because the space is growing and you have all this energy, there's now a gravitational attraction back toward the center. So if I take two gravitating bodies, two masses, and I part them like this, it turns out that mathematically the way that comes into your equations is it comes in with a negative potential energy that gets added into the total energy balance. So oddly enough, you can start from basically nothing, and you can have this expansion, and the kinetic energy and the expansion energy is offset by the negative potential energy that you're adding into the system when you're expanding it. So, again, you may say, this sort of sounds crazy, but it works mathematically. So if you look at energy conservation in this wacky picture, you are not violating energy conservation. And it leads Alan Guth, actually has a famous quote where he says, the universe is the ultimate free lunch. You can basically start from nothing and create a universe, this picture. It's absurd. But it is consistent within the physics that we know. Okay, so why would you swallow such an absurd idea? And here's why. Let us suppose that for this little bit of space that we initially have in a quantum fluctuation, let us suppose it has arbitrary curvature. Because we'd like to be able to have it have arbitrary curvature, because I have no reason to believe it has any, you know, special time. If I have an object that has arbitrary curvature, let us take, for example, a golf ball, clearly curved, and I take it and I make it extremely big, then I don't see the curvature. It looks flat, like the Earth, right? So if I take a golf ball and instantly inflate it to be the size of the Earth locally, it looks very flat to me. So in inflation, you may start out with any arbitrary curvature you want for that initial bit of the universe. And you now take it and instantly inflate it to something extremely big. And whatever this curvature happens to be, it doesn't matter what it is driven toward being flat on a small scale. Yeah.
There's a, like a mathematical term for that topology. Or it is
well, we are thinking about different topologies.
So when you're saying it's flat, you're saying it follows those rules that when you're in different spots, it looks like a lower dimension.
Basically, I'm taking whatever the curving structure is, and I'm making it so big on the scale of our observable universe that you can't detect the curvature, regardless of what it was.
So that's what that
is. We're going to look at how we know this, but when I tell you that when we look at the large-scale geometry of the space in our universe, we see it to be flat, this completely drives you to that answer. Flat is a special case, and this is exactly what you would get if you had in place.
Okay, so what that means is that if you have this wacky idea called inflation, you solve the flatness problem. All right, let us think for a moment that we have the early universe. And in this early universe, you have lots of magnetic monopoles form. And I now take it, and I expand the universe to be vastly, vastly larger than our observable universe. Whatever was there initially, the density of it drops to zero, because basically I just took that same amount of stuff and I now spread it over something that's so big, it's,
that we're only seeing a small fraction of it, so the probability of seeing a magnetic monopole in our observable universe is now zero. So it solves the magnetic monopole problem. The singularity problem. Well, in the singularity problem, I mean, there's going to be a lot of discussion about what happens right at the start, but basically quantum fluctuations are things we know about, in a sense. It can be really, really small, but it's not infinitely small. So we don't really have the issue with all of the energy of the universe going to a point. We have this strange fluctuation and then inflation happening where you have this balance of the energy in the universe sort of canceling out with the gravitational potential energy. So you have this weird sort of situation. You still have a very high energy density at the start, but you don't go to the point where all the equations get crazy. So in that sense, you sort of solve the singularity problem. And now, let's look at the structure problem. If I have a quantum fluctuation in energy, remember what that's basically saying is, if I look at something over a short enough period of time, I don't have any idea what its energy is. And that then, you can imagine that energy takes different forms. So, being the particles in space. As this is expanding, as this space is expanding, as inflation happens, you will have local regions where quantum fluctuations in energy happen. But at the same time, those regions are expanding so fast that basically quantum fluctuations that we have on a very small scale initially get stretched up cosmic scales. And you can predict the pattern of those non-uniformities. So what that leads to is, as you now go through a large-scale universe, you've taken small quantum non-uniformities in energy that sort of we know happen to be there all the time, and you blow them up to cosmic scales. But they'll have different sizes and different frequencies because things where delta E is very small will be around for a longer delta T. So you will have more fluctuations of tiny energies than you'll have of big energies. Now take it all of a sudden. So I take these non-uniformities in energy and I now blow it up cosmic scale. Okay? And then whatever happens, the space slows down in its expansion. And when it slows down its expansion, the energy of that expansion sort of gets transformed into radiation and eventually into matter. And it maps directly on what we perceive as our Big Bang. But one of the things that comes out of this is that the space that is like what we experience as part of our observable universe is vastly larger than our observable universe. And it comes directly out of inflation, and it has to be that way, because remember, we start with something that had arbitrary curvature, and we have to blow the universe up to be so big that that arbitrary curvature looks almost exactly flat. So at the time that this happened, you know, people say like, oh, you know, basically in this instant, the universe became as large as an orange or something of that scale. But remember, at that time, the observable universe is effectively nothing because it's the speed of light times 10 to the minus 35 seconds. So on the scale of the size of the observable universe, the universe in which this is formed, that seems to be from inflation, is vastly, vastly
different. Now, could, in, say, if you have this orange, okay, could there are different parts of the orange have different rules, or does the whole...
No, not at this point. No, let me eat those words a little bit. So you have this orange inflating. And then you're facing the question of what stops the inflation. So we'll talk a bit about what the inflation could be, But there are ways of changing the expansion of space, the nature of the inflation, through quantum fluctuations. And so what will happen is, as this orange is expanding, at a point where you have a quantum fluctuation in here, you can change the nature of the space so that expansion slows down. And it is that that sort of became our, what we see as our Big Bang. So, one of the issues is, we have this inflating universe. I can't stop inflation everywhere at once because I'm causally disconnected. So the inflation has to stop or slow down at a point where you can have a quantum fluctuation, whatever the characteristic that space has that's causing it to inflate. So you have this inflating orange, and our universe effectively is born in a piece of this, but the space that's inflating has to continue to inflate, and you can have other quantum fluctuations in the space that can cause the inflation to stop at those points. Those different characteristics, different types of fluctuations, might give different physical laws in these regions, and that is the origin of the type 2 multiverse, which is the bubble multiverse, where effectively here's our Big Bang, we have an inflating matrix, and you had something else happen over here. It could look like a Big Bang. Sometimes you'll have the space basically start to expand and then collapse because of the nature of the physical characteristics of the space. So you have all sorts of weird things that can happen, but they're now sort of separated by this inflating matrix. So if you're bothered by, you know, what is it that started inflating, and you like the idea of the steady state universe, there is something which is known as eternal inflation, which is basically you can sort of make the argument that you have always had an inflating matrix, and here and there you have quantum fluctuations that give you sort of what we see as our Big Bang, and this inflating matrix keeps going forever. So we actually have a version of sort of the steady state universe, but we have these regions of space that were causally connected, where we're causally connected with a piece of it. But you have all this other weirdness happening where we're not causally connected.
Does the word multiverse really have to be there? Or did you just say a more complicated universe? Yeah.
Well, I mean, again, it depends on how you define the universe. So if you say that the universe is all of what it potentially could be there, regardless, then I guess it encompasses everything. If you, and if I define the universe as that which we can ever possibly be causally connected to, that is, that we can experience. And it is from that definition that you then can define multiverse.
Alright, so I'm going to clarify some of these things as we go. We'll talk more about them, but let me keep going for a minute. Okay. So how wacky is this?
Alright, so now what I hope I've convinced you of, or at least made you somewhat of, and this is the thought, that we have compelling, strong scientific evidence supporting the Big Bang. Given what we know about the physics of the universe, we have compelling and strong reasons to believe that the Big Bang in and of itself cannot possibly be true. And if you have this weird idea of inflation happening, it actually then maps into the Big Bang and it makes the Big Bang work. So that's sort of the idea. Fixes all these problems at the cost of this weirdness and inflation. So how crazy is it? Turns out that cosmology has been a fabulously active area in the last 20 years. And things that have happened in your lifetime have been really breathtaking in terms of science. One of the things is that for 30 years, people looked at the cosmic microwave background and it looked completely uniform. And in the 1990s, an experiment called COPI, a satellite, discovered the variations in the temperature of the cosmic microwave background. It discovered the structure, okay, at 1 part in 10 to the 5th. And this has to be there from the point of view of the Big Bang, because without that, you have no reason for the large-scale structure of the universe to exist. So in a sense, it wasn't a surprise, but it was a big deal that it was actually observed. Because do you really believe in the Big Bang? I mean, it's a pretty crazy idea. Yeah, I see the cosmic microwave background, the distribution of elements is pretty compelling. Now you go and you see the fluctuations in the temperature of the cosmic microwave background, and the size and the frequency of those fluctuations agrees pretty well with the mass density variations that we see in the large-scale structure of the universe. I don't know. You kind of go, holy crap, that's really compelling. Okay? So this is a big, big deal. And part of, I think, the writing assignment this week that I want you to think about is when the physicist George Smoot won a Nobel Prize for this satellite observation, he did a press conference, and at the press conference he said, if you're religious, this is like seeing God. And I want you to defend that statement. Right? That is sort of how phenomenal and exciting this is. It's just absolutely spectacular. Okay, that observation was made in the early 90s. Another thing that we saw is, and I've already alluded to it a couple of times, is the universe is locally flat. I mean, is flat on a large scale. So let me come back to that. All right. Here is, if I were to take all of the sky and project it down on a plot, so you sort of look at the map of the sky, and you were to look at the temperature of the cosmic microwave background as it comes to you, this is what COBE saw. So this is what George Smoot was talking about. And you think, wow, that's really ugly, or whatever. Yeah, the color scheme they chose is pretty hideous. But the blue and the red here correspond to differences in temperature of 1 part in 10 to the 5th. So you have to have a pretty sensitive eye to see the variations at all. And then they false color it so that you can really pick it out. Okay. This was 1992, and it turns out that the experiment that they used basically was like you looking at something without wearing glasses when you need them. So you could see the basic structure, but you couldn't resolve things very well because the instrument wasn't powerful enough. So they have sent out more powerful and sensitive instruments since then. And that picture, for example, in 2003, became this. And now you see that you're sensitive at much smaller scales in terms of the size of the fluctuations. You now have a very rich set of sizes here. There's a lot of information right here. In fact, we're going to talk a whole lot about it. In fact, I'm always, whenever I look at it, I'm stunned at how much information is actually in this plot. But let us think about it for just a moment. Look at this large region here, and have a large hot region here. Okay? That sort of tells me, if I go and I look at the matter distribution in our universe, I should see with a frequency that's not so big here, I should see some regions where it's devoid of stuff, and some regions where I have lots of galaxies. And if I look at the whole night sky here, I only see a region this big, maybe here, possibly there, possibly here. I see these dense regions, 2, 3, 4. So over the entire night sky, if I count the number of regions that have certain sizes, then I can map out the basic structure of the universe. So the way that we do it is we say, let us look at different angles of the sky and ask, how big a structure do I see? Here's a pretty big structure, and it subtends a big part of the sky. But I don't have many of those. So I can plot how many structures on the sky I see of that size. And then I could ask, for example, how many structures do I see that are little tiny? And they're all over the place, okay? Because I have lots of little tiny structures. So you can map out how often you see different structures of different sizes. And we sort of know what that is in the universe in terms of the matter we see. And it really sort of needs to match this to a large extent. Okay? And the other thing is, if I now have different models of the universe, this hot expanding space, okay, I will have different predictions for the different sizes of structures that I should see here. So if I study in gory detail the different sizes of all these different structures, it turns out I'm very sensitive to what this type of matter and type of interactions were present at the very earliest stages of the universe. So this picture really enables us to go back and start making scientific hypotheses of what was happening, what was driving this universe in terms of the size. So just to give you one bit about this, this whole idea of inflation was not taken all that seriously until the physicists that I showed you on that picture a little while ago, they had a conference where they all went and pondered this. And they actually calculated what the size frequency should be if inflation happened of the different quantum fluctuations that you would expand the cosmic scales. And when they calculated the frequency of those things, they got something that they thought corresponded sort of in a reasonable way to what we think we see. That's one of the things you can try to do with this. You can ask, if I inflate the quantum fluctuations, do I get the different size fluctuations that correspond to what I sort of see in this cosmic microwave background? And that would be a way of sort of thinking or coming up with evidence that perhaps inflation actually happened. But when they came up with a reasonable way of generating the structure that we didn't discover for another 10 or 15 years, they actually began to think that the model might potentially be a valid model for cosmology. So this was like back in the 1980s, before this was actually seen. And then you begin to put it at a test. All right, we're going to come back to it. We are well and truly into the weird stuff.